Continuing with this spontaneous case-based theme, we next chatted with Dr. Don Dizon, who told me about a 68-year-old woman in his practice.
This was a female patient who actually had come in to see us after she had presented to her primary gynecologist due to vaginal bleeding. She had previously been very healthy, 68 years old, married, but of Ashkenazi Jewish background, with a family history of ovarian cancer in her mother, as well as breast cancer in her paternal father. So again, we're already thinking BRCA mutation carrier in either or both lineages. So her examination at that time did not show any endometrial or uterine pathology, but did show a very large ovarian mass. It was about 6 centimeters in size. Her CA-125 was elevated to 212, and our normal here is 21. So she underwent a CAT scan, which showed the ovarian mass, but no evidence of significant upper abdominal disease.
So can I just ask you, how often do you see vaginal bleeding with ovarian cancer, and what's the pathophysiology?
So, you know, if someone's presenting with vaginal bleeding, we tend to diagnose endometrial problems. So either endometrial hyperplasia or endometrial cancer and asynchronous ovarian cancer. So it's not a frequent sign that I think of with advanced ovarian cancer. And typically DNCs, if they're done in women with ovarian cancer who present with bleeding, does not show any evidence of a malignancy. So it's not like you can do a DNC and pick up ovarian cancer in the vast majority of cases presenting with bleeding. So I guess in answering your question, it's a pretty rare thing. So for her, though, it was a sentinel event that led to the diagnosis. Whether or not it was related is not clear to me at all.
Right. It could not be related. I mean, I guess, was it later determined there was like erosion, you know, from the ovary into adjacent areas that would cause it?
No, in fact, for this patient, she was found to have stage 3 ovarian cancer. It was 3A, which means that although she had omental disease, it wasn't seen with the naked eye. It was diagnosed on microscopic evaluation only. She had a tumor in the ovary. There was no evidence of involvement of the uterus, interestingly.
And what was her BRCA status?
She ultimately tested positive for a BRCA1 mutation.
So I guess we can pick up later in terms of the implications of that to her and to her family. Now, this was in October 2009.
That's
not that long ago, but the way things are moving, it sort of is long ago.
Right.
So what happened at that point?
So remember, so in October of 2009, we had the first results of GOG-218, which suggested a benefit in terms of progression-free survival with the incorporation of bevacizumab with carboplatin and paclitaxel. The overall survival was not seen in GOG-218, at least in the first analysis, although I should caution that it may not be seen at all, given that the study was designed and powered to show a progression-free survival advantage. So in terms of being a positive study, it did meet that endpoint. So our patient here had presented when this data had just been released, and the gynecologic oncology group had already opened a follow-up study to 218, which was presented to her, and she ultimately accepted. So the trial she participated on was GOG-252. It's a 3-arm study and is asking a question of, should we do intravenous with intraperitoneal chemotherapy or stick to intravenous therapy alone? All 3 arms in that study have bevacizumab incorporated in them with chemotherapy and as consolidative single-agent treatment.
And what was she randomized to?
So she was randomized to intraperitoneal carboplatin on day 1, with IV paclitaxel on days 1, 8, and 15 of a 21-day cycle, with bevacizumab starting at cycle 2.
And how did she do, and what's her current status?
So she actually did quite well. Her CA-125 normalized right after surgery, which is an incredibly good prognostic sign. She was able to complete all chemotherapy and the bevacizumab. But interestingly, on the bevacizumab, she had a late worsening of grade 1 neuropathy, which was present during the chemotherapy. But on the bevacizumab consolidation, the neuropathy actually became painful, which leads me to believe there was some component of bevacizumab that was actually worsening the neuropathy. And ultimately, it led to her discontinuing treatment.
So you're thinking that the bevacizumab contributed to her neuropathy?
It might have, but again, she was also getting a weekly treatment with paclitaxel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you said bevacizumab and neuropathy in the same sentence, right. I was like, I'm not sure I've heard that one before.
Right, right. And, you know, the interesting thing is there's not a great experience. So we're actually learning a lot about weekly paclitaxel with bevacizumab on this study as well.
But she had a problem with neuropathy.
Right. So she ended up getting 7 treatments with maintenance bevacizumab before stopping, and she remains without evidence of disease today. So she's going on 18 months, NED since diagnosis.
And what fraction of people who just received carboplatin paclitaxel have this level of neuropathy?
I would probably say painful neuropathy from carboplatin and paclitaxel is a rare thing. Obviously, you know, numbness and tingling tend to be the symptoms that present. Grade 3 neuropathy, you know, when they're unable to button their shirt or use their hands with any dexterity, is a fairly rare event in the single digits. I'd say the overall proportion of patients who probably develop neuropathy from carboplatin and paclitaxel alone is probably on the order of 20%. This is everybody from, you know, just minor symptoms to grade 3.
Now, if she were not eligible for this study or for some reason didn't want to participate in it, what kind of treatment plan would you have had for off-study?
So my standard of care off-study is to do carboplatin with paclitaxel. And if I'm doing an intravenous regimen, so say someone does not have an optimal cytoreduction, which in the gynecologic oncology group is defined as less than 1 centimeter of disease at the end of surgery at any one site, then we do stick with intravenous chemotherapy. My standards have been to offer both every 3 week carboplatin and paclitaxel, or else carboplatin with weekly paclitaxel based on the Japanese randomized trial that was done, which showed a potential survival advantage with weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin.
What about bevacizumab?
So I have not been offering bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting off a clinical trial.
So I guess for you, in a way, this trial, all 3 arms are experimental.
Correct. Yes.
It is kind of interesting, though, that it is present in, you know, all 3 of those arms. We just pulled off the web an electronic publication that hasn't come out yet, American Journal of Clinical Oncology, Where Do Anti-Angiogenic Agents Belong in the Treatment Algorithm of Ovarian Cancer? So this is all fresh in your mind. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, we had some new things presented at ASCO. So where are we in terms of bevacizumab and anti-angiogenic therapy?
Well, I think ASCO is helping us put into context where perhaps bevacizumab will be most useful. So there were companion oral presentations of a platinum-sensitive relapse study, as well as ICON-7, which was the international study of adjuvant bevacizumab with chemotherapy. And the survival advantage in the adjuvant context appears to be fairly small, except in the presentation that we heard at ASCO, they were able to identify a potential subgroup which may really benefit from bevacizumab. And that subgroup, which that presentation was by Professor Christensen, was a group of women with what was defined as high-risk cancer at diagnosis, meaning they were suboptimally resected, so they were stage 3 with over 1 centimeter of disease at the end of surgery, or else were stage 4. And in that subgroup, there appeared to be a survival advantage of at least 8 months, favoring the use of bevacizumab. But for the entire population treated in ICON-7, the survival advantage with the use of bevacizumab was only 3% more than compared to chemotherapy.
Now, is that because there haven't been enough events/deaths yet, or just that there's no survival benefit?
The analysis that was presented at ASCO was an analysis requested by the European Regulatory Authority. So before reviewing the data for approval in Europe, I think it was the French authority had asked for a survival analysis. So this was unplanned in the statistical plan, but given it was requested by the regulatory board, they did present this. I believe there is still too few events, so this is fairly preliminary yet. But again, I think the striking thing that warranted an oral presentation was the potential then segregating out of women who may benefit. And the ICON-7 data supported Dr. Agajanian's data, which was presented also from the platinum-sensitive trial of carboplatin and gemcitabine as a skeleton with or without bevacizumab. And in that trial, women were allowed to go on but had to have some evidence of disease. So we were able to demonstrate in those women recurrent with disease that there was a benefit in terms of progression-free survival with the use of bevacizumab, although overall survival was not yet mature, and certainly the hazard ratio was not significant. There was a 6-month advantage to the use of bevacizumab with that combination of chemotherapy. So I think the take-home point from these specific studies suggests that bevacizumab will play a role in the presence of disease. So as opposed to a curative situation, i.e. adjuvant treatment, the benefits of bevacizumab in addition to standard chemotherapy is probably not going to be realized. But perhaps in women who have more poor prognostic features or else recurrent disease, they may be the ones to benefit from the treatment.
Do you think the leadership of the GOG believes that? And if so, how come everybody in this trial gets bevacizumab?
Well, again, I think one of the things about the design of GOG 252, and it runs across the cooperative groups, is that the design of subsequent studies occurs before the results of the prior ones are available. So as an example, there is a study in patients who have not had a optimal cytoreduction, and that is GOG 262. Which is comparing carboplatin with either weekly or every 3-week paclitaxel. And in that study, the bevacizumab is optional. So 262 design was influenced by the results of GOG 218.
And what about, I thought I heard, and maybe I was confusing it with this one you just mentioned, that it was optional in 252. That's not the case?
It's not the case yet in 252, no.
Interesting. A couple other things about this patient. Any other bevacizumab issues, hypertension, nosebleeds?
She did have the hypertension, actually was requiring 3 drugs to treat her hypertension. Fortunately, within 6 months of coming off bevacizumab, her hypertension has resolved. She did have issues with epistaxis as well, and that resolved in a fairly short time frame, within 3 months of stopping bevacizumab. The only residual side effect she's dealing with now is the neuropathy, but it's no longer painful. So I'd say within 8 to 12 weeks of coming off bevacizumab, she had stopped narcotics.
Interesting. And what about her breasts? What are you thinking there?
So her breast issues, she's still grappling with the implications of being a BRCA1 carrier. I think her concentration has been to the life-threatening diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And I think it's a tricky thing to try to talk someone through preventive surgery, i.e. bilateral mastectomy, in the context of a new diagnosis of ovarian cancer. But what we did do is have her meet with one of our breast surgeons and institute at least a high-risk screening protocol for her breasts. So she's going through mammogram, alternating with MRI at 6-month intervals. And we're continuing to discuss with her the option of a prophylactic mastectomy.
And I know you have a major interest in breast cancer also. And there was a recent paper, my mind's a blur about where, about the issue of whether MR in some way can, you know, replace bilateral mastectomy in, for example, BRCA carriers. How much do you think you lose by not doing it? In other words, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's only really one way to prevent breast cancer in this population, and that's surgically. For the woman who is not comfortable taking such a drastic step that will change her body image for a perceived increased risk of breast cancer in the future, then I think the best we have to offer her is screening with MRI, which I think is very reasonable to do.
So I got a feeling there's people out there listening to this are going, what about tamoxifen? Because actually, there was a paper at ASCO looking at tamoxifen in BRCA carriers, and it was pretty effective.
Yes, and I think the range of options are already improving in terms of primary prevention now with exemestane and the data presented by Dr. Paul Goss regarding exemestane and primary prevention. And those figures are fairly dramatic, over 60% reduction in the risk of future breast events. But again, in a population who the risk of developing cancer is so high, really the only prevention strategy that is going to be effective is surgical.
But actually, it's interesting you mentioned the Goss presentation, because I think that's the first primary prevention AI study I've seen. Is that enough for you to take action?
I think it's very, very impressive, yeah. I think it's going to probably change the landscape of primary prevention discussions with women. I can tell you one of the effects that is sometimes leading to women not choosing tamoxifen is the side effect profile of tamoxifen, with the risk of endometrial hyperplasia, vaginal bleeding, and subsequent development of endometrial cancer. So it's always been a slippery slope when you discuss preventing breast cancer, but then potentially increasing the risk of another type of cancer with your same drug.
Of course, in most people, at least if they have their ovaries or ovarian function, you know, an AI is not going to be out on the table.
But that's correct.
For example, this lady, I guess, could take an AI, right?
She could definitely take an AI, yeah.
And, you know, the only thing is people complain about Tamoxifen forever, but I'm not sure AIs are going to go down that well with arthralgias.
That's correct. Yeah. And certainly the arthralgias is a very real issue. I think the bigger issue that we need to confront as oncologists for women on AIs is how much better can we do in tracking bone health? You know, bone density tests are what is the standard. It's what ASCO says to follow on an annual basis. But women are still breaking bones even with normal DEXA scans.
So a couple more questions about this lady. What would you say right now if she were to ask, what's the chance at this point that I'm never going to have another problem? Because I think that does relate to a decision like bilateral mastectomy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with you. Her risk is going to be highest for developing a relapse in the first 3 years. So after the completion of treatment, and before her, I would define completion of treatment as completion of the chemotherapeutic component of her treatment. Okay. And that's another thing that's very confusing these days. If for someone on maintenance bevacizumab who, say, progresses on bevacizumab, are they considered chemotherapy refractory or not? I tend to still count chemotherapy-free time from the end of the chemotherapy component. So from the end of chemotherapy, counting out 3 years is going to be her biggest risk of relapse.
So what would you have said originally at diagnosis her risk of relapse was?
Well, I think at diagnosis, just with surgical therapy alone, if she did not do chemotherapy, it was probably going to be as high as 90%.
How about with chemo?
With chemotherapy, I think we've improved that probably down to more 60%.
So one final question about her, again, outside of protocol setting, I think you said you give her intravenous therapy. When do you use intraperitoneal therapy?
Well, this woman actually was randomized to the intraperitoneal carboplatin arm. And so it's still only something I consider in women who have an optimal cytoreduction. And so one of the posters that we presented at ASCO, which could have been relevant for her, is trying to find a way to make intraperitoneal therapy more tolerable. And that was a poster that was presented at ASCO this year. It was a feasibility study from the gynecologic oncology group. And what we did was simplified Deb Armstrong's GOG-172 regimen, which was a day one, day two, day eight treatment. And instead of day one, day two, we gave both the intraperitoneal cisplatin and the intravenous paclitaxel on day one, followed that with a day eight treatment, and we were able to demonstrate feasibility with a simplified regimen and tolerance as well.
And how did she do with intraperitoneal therapy?
She did well with intraperitoneal therapy. She did not have much in the way of toxicity. She was able to receive all six cycles.
At what age do you start backing off from intraperitoneal therapy? Or I know you'll say, you know, it's all about their condition, but really, you know, is there an age where you just don't do it?
I don't have a hard and fast stop rule.
How about if I say, who's the oldest patient you've treated with it?
82.
Okay. So, you know, this paper that just got electronically published, the thing I love about it is you take like about, I don't know, 10 new anti-angiogenic strategies and summarize in one paragraph, you know, what the deal is. So let me see if you can actually sort of flip it into audio. We talked about bevacizumab, but I really like this section that you did on multi-targeted TKIs and also VEGF trap, which I've never understood. So let me fly through a few of these. I guess these are agents under investigation.
That's correct.
The first one on the list kind of surprised me, imatinib.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So imatinib, as you know, is FDA approved really for the treatment of Philadelphia chromosome positive CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia. But it goes beyond just blocking specific pathways related to the Philadelphia chromosome. It actually blocks platelet-derived growth factor receptor as well as c-KIT. And so there's been work looking at how to utilize this multi-targeted TKI in gynecologic malignancies. And most of the experience has been really obtained in ovarian cancers. And, you know, the data is out there, response rate of about 20% in one experience. There was another one at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which looked at it as a maintenance therapy in women who had a complete response after retreatment with chemotherapy. And, you know, compared to historical controls, that study was negative in terms of having any benefit in progression-free survival. Obviously, the benefit of a drug like imatinib is that it is orally available. But in terms of where can we see it used, it's very unclear as to where that will end up or if it will end up being effective. I think the data is very plus or minus.
Yeah, well, I see this one thing that says one CR and four PRs, and I guess that's to the drug alone, and that got my attention. Right.
Well, you know, that's interesting because going back to even how the gynecologic oncology group was thinking about anti-angiogenesis drugs, we thought it would have a cytostatic effect. So PFS at 6 months was the primary endpoint of our studies looking at biologics, but then bevacizumab came out and was demonstrating a fairly provocative response rate. And again, imatinib also does that. I think the primary endpoints of these trials as we go forward is probably going to go away from response rates, as we can discuss in some of the later drugs, and more towards what is the survival advantage of these agents. And I think that might be the more relevant endpoint in biologic therapies.
One of the things I really like about this paper is that for each of these agents, you list the primary mechanism. And the next one is BIBF-1120, anti-VEGFR, anti-PDGFR, and anti-FGFR.
Right. So FGFR is a fibroblast growth factor receptor pathway, which is the novel component to the TKI of the BIBF-1120 drug. One study was presented in ASCO 2010, where they took women in at least a second remission from recurrent ovarian cancer and gave them placebo or their drug, BIBF-1120, and showed that, again, 6-month progression-free survival was far better using their drug than using placebo, with a tripling of the PFS from 5 to 14%. Now, this drug also has its toxicity issues, but if you compare it to cediranib, bevacizumab, it looks, at least on the surface, as not as toxic, i.e., it does cause transaminitis as one of its major side effects, but the transaminitis is transient and reverses when the drug is held. There is abdominal pain that's reported and nausea. Again, nice thing about it, it's oral. So whether or not this is going to also play a role is also very preliminary. There is a study that's being coordinated by the German Cooperative Group in Ovarian Cancer, AGO, looking at chemotherapy, a carboplatin and paclitaxel backbone with this drug, followed by maintenance with this drug, again, compared to placebo. And I think that will let us know if this drug has a future, at least in the frontline setting, which is still very early, fairly exciting, but we'll have to wait and see.
So another one that has, I think, a really cool name, but I never quite grasp it, which is aflibercept VEGF trap.
Yes. So VEGF trap is, as opposed to the inhibition of tissue-bound VEGF, or tissue-associated VEGF receptor, this actually circulates in the system and binds to circulating VEGF, and that's the mechanism of action here. And there was a study that was presented at ASCO by Rob Coleman at MD Anderson looking at aflibercept with docetaxel with fairly encouraging results in recurrent ovarian cancer. The studies in frontline, you know, pretty early to say whether or not there's a benefit. One of the more intriguing studies done with this drug was looking at whether or not it could help control ascites. And it was a very, very small study presented a few years ago by Nicoletta Colombo. And it showed that of 15 patients treated who had required numerous paracentesis, there was a doubling in the time to paracentesis in at least 8 of those folks. So again, what's the future of aflibercept? Is it in advanced, frontline, recurrent, or as palliation? Again, I think that's what we're looking to see. And again, whether or not we'll see benefits if combined with chemotherapy, again, is another interesting place to look.
You commented in the paper about the GI problems or bowel obstruction that's been seen with this. Can you talk a little more about that? And also, do you see hypertension and sort of BEV type things?
So with aflibercept, there is not a big increase in the rates of hypertension, although it is possible. I think the side effects do overlap somewhat with bevacizumab. The major problems here, and again, the studies are very heterogeneous in the group that they saw. Again, if you're looking at women who are requiring paracentesis chronically versus those women with advanced ovarian cancer, but had two or to even five lines of therapy, the baseline status is going to be different. But, you know, obstruction rates of 40%, with aflibercept, whether or not that's related to disease is something to raise a red flag on. In terms of the bowel obstructions rates, I'm not sure how much of that is going to be real. And I say that based on the bevacizumab experience in which, you know, one study showed a rate of bowel perforation of 14%. Subsequent studies after that, ICON 7, OCEANS, for example, have not demonstrated that high of a rate.
Right. And, you know, I guess the thing that's confused me about this agent is it kind of sounds similar to bevacizumab, except it's not an antibody.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. All right. There's another one. I like the name, vascular disrupting agents.
Yeah, so these are very cool drugs, work very differently from bevacizumab. What these agents do is they lead to the collapse of existing vasculature in the tumor. And there was one study that has now been published looking at the combination of fosbritabulin with carboplatin and paclitaxel in a platinum-resistant population. And they showed a response rate of 32%, which is, you know, again, in a non-randomized setting, unclear as to how much of that is due to chemotherapy versus chemotherapy with your biologic. The side effect profile of these drugs appears very different from bevacizumab. There is hypertension, but the hypertension is not one that comes on with repeat treatments in clinical trials. It tends to be an acute hypertensive episode, even with acute pain that can be seen. And the mechanism of the hypertension appears to be more tumor-related. So as you give this drug, there can be sudden collapse of the tumor vasculature leading to actual swelling of the tumor, causing pain, which also may cause this sort of hypertensive response.
So the last agent was actually presented last year at ASCO for the first time. Another really interesting mechanism, angiopoietins, AMG-386.
Yeah, so AMG-386 is continuing in development. The Gynecologic Oncology Group is probably going to incorporate this agent into one of its upfront trials going forward. A lot of interest in this drug based on last year's presentation, which was a study in recurrent ovarian cancer, weekly paclitaxel with placebo versus with the angiopoietin AMG-386. And again, really suggesting benefits in terms of progression-free survival with AMG-386 on board. And I think probably of all of these drugs, AMG-386, there's a lot of excitement that this may play a role in the disease. And I think one of the problems we're going to have as a community of oncologists is that there's a lot of drugs out there targeting angiogenesis, and how to sequence the drugs or which one is the best of these agents is going to be one of the problems we're going to face going forward.
What about the side effects and toxicity you've been seeing with this agent?
Some nausea and vomiting has been seen with this drug. I actually participated in the AMG-386 study that was presented last year. And I can tell you from our own experience that hypertension was not a big theme in the side effect profile. Obstructions of the bowel tended to occur, but again, whether or not that's due to the drug or the disease is a very big question. In my experience with this agent, women who had recurrent bowel obstructions tended to be related to the disease as opposed to the drug. Pretty well tolerated overall, I have to say.
Was this open label?
No, it was blinded.
So, I mean, could you tell, I guess maybe there weren't enough patients, it would just be more anecdotal, but, you know, there wasn't any particular profile that would let you know this patient's on that drug.
Yeah, the only way that I think, and it was my conclusion that she was actually on the active drug, given her progression-free survival, which was far longer than I expected with weekly paclitaxel.
Interesting.
Yeah, she did actually very well on this drug.
So thinking about this lady, she's BRCA1. What about the biology of ovarian cancers in patients with BRCA mutations? I've heard it said, quote, they have better prognosis or better response to treatment or whatever. Is that real?
Well, there has been an observation that women who have BRCA mutations are more sensitive to platinum. So it has also been anecdotally reported that BRCA mutation carriers with ovarian cancer live longer than women without BRCA mutations. You know, I've seen enough women with both to suggest that may be true.
That's interesting, though. I didn't think about that, you know, because again, on this webcast, we talked about this paper. I think it was actually at a Dana-Farber that Eric Weiner was involved with, looking at cis and carbo in patients with metastatic triple negative disease. And there was like a 30% response rate. So I never thought about it, but maybe the quote positive BRCA prognosis in ovarian is because they respond better to platinums?
I think so. Huh. I think there's something to that. I mean, I think with triple negative breast cancer, there's been that observation that platinum appears to work better in that population as well.
But, you know, I've got to say, I don't know, you tell me, that paper, that Isikoff thing at ASCO, to me looked, I mean, before that, there was like little stuff out there, but I couldn't get a clear answer whether platinums really help.
You know, I think the issue here is that ovarian cancer is not like breast cancer. So, you know, the lessons we learn from breast are not translatable necessarily. I mean, look at the PARP inhibitor story.
Absolutely.
In breast versus ovary. I think for some reason, these drugs appear more active, at least preliminarily, in ovarian cancer than in breast. We're seeing much more positive data in the gynecologic malignancies, ovary specifically, with PARP inhibitors. And it might be because platinum agents are such a predominant drug in the treatment of those.
Let's talk about your 68-year-old lady.
Yes. So the second patient we can discuss is a 68-year-old female who had been diagnosed with stage 3C ovarian cancer in 2007. At that time, she received standard of care therapy of intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel and went into a clinical complete response. I then enrolled her in a tumor vaccine study of abagovimab versus placebo, also known as the MIMOSA study, which she stayed on from October of 2007 all the way up to April 2008 when she clinically progressed by CT scan. So the hope was that in this placebo-controlled blinded study, that women who got abagovimab would experience an improvement in progression-free survival versus those on the placebo.
So again, in this lady, could you tell whether she was on the drug or not?
I could not tell if she was on the drug or not.
So she got it from October 2007 to disease progression April 2008. That doesn't sound that great.
Yeah, no, she progressed.
Do we know at this point whether this agent has activity?
It does not have activity. And it was presented by Professor Fisterra for the AGO, and the PFS was the same in both arms.
So what was the next step with this lady?
So she went back on chemotherapy. Her platinum-free interval was about 7 months by the time we decided to start chemotherapy. So she went back on platinum at 7 months, and she got carboplatin and gemcitabine and went back into a clinical complete response.
And then what?
So then we enrolled her in a second clinical trial of a PARP inhibitor, olaparib, versus placebo. And this was, again, a blinded study open to women in a second remission from platinum-sensitive disease. And it was a one-to-one randomization of the oral agent olaparib versus placebo.
And again, this study was restricted to people in CR?
It was restricted to people who responded. So so the eligibility criteria is achieved best response and with stable findings.
And did she ever have BRCA testing?
She did not have BRCA testing.
I'm kind of curious, and we'll talk about PARP inhibitors. And actually, we just did a telecast two nights ago with Joyce O'Shaughnessy and Eric Weiner about the iniparib story in breast cancer. And we were talking about this question of, in triple negative metastatic disease, do you get BRCA testing in an older patient without family history? What about that same question with ovarian cancer, particularly recurrent disease?
Yeah, no, it's my feeling that all patients who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer warrant BRCA testing.
Really?
I do. I think so.
I'm guessing that's more your opinion than, say, the NCCN?
Yeah, that's my opinion. The NCCN guidelines for BRCA testing really fall into family and personal history.
Right. Well, the only thing is, though, that the ovarian data, and I'm curious about your thoughts, there was some data presented at ASCO 2010, and then there was some more this year, suggests that it seems like, at least with olaparib, you see responses in people who are BRCA negative with ovarian cancer.
Right. And, you know, it shows the importance of perhaps in serous cancers, homologous recombination repair may be the deficit that's important as opposed to or in addition to BRCA status itself.
And so this lady goes on this study. And first of all, again, with her, could you tell whether she was getting the active drug or not?
I was suspicious she was not getting the active drug because she tolerated really well.
Have you had patients who you knew got olaparib, and what did you see?
Well, the only suspicions that I had was on how women tolerated the agent. So I personally enrolled onto what is known as Study 19. This was Study 19 she participated on. There was a profile of patients. They either tolerated the drug really well with no side effects at all, or they had a really tough time taking the drug and experienced nausea and vomiting.
So she got it at the point she was in a CR, and then what happened?
Yeah.
Or she got it or placebo?
She got study drug, yes. She stayed on this drug for about 4 months.
And then what happened?
Well, then she went on to third and then fourth and then fifth line therapy, ended up becoming very symptomatic due to recurrent pleural effusions, and ultimately died at the beginning of the year.
And did she ever receive bevacizumab?
She did not receive bevacizumab, to concerns that I had over her clinical status by the time she had progressed on third-line therapy. So there's a profile of patients that I tend not to give bevacizumab to based on some work we've done retrospectively here. And one of the things that we looked at that seemed to support the onset of bevacizumab toxicity was prior lines of therapy. So if they went beyond four or even five lines of therapy, there was an increase in the incident rates of either severe hypertension or else bowel perforation.
So I keep a list, and it's a pretty short list, of agents that are not available that oncologists in practice hear about and really want to get a hold of. And, you know, it's kind of hard to say what the criteria are for that. But, for example, crizotinib and lung cancer is on that list. T-DM1 and breast cancer is on that list. I think brentuximab, vedotin, and Hodgkin and anaplastic large cell popped onto the list real fast. Should olaparib be on that list?
Well, I think olaparib should probably be on that list. I think most medical oncologists have a desire to offer these drugs to their patients based on the story on homologous recombination repair deficits, but also based on the story that with BRCA positive patients, there is now credible New England Journal of Medicine published cases of prolonged disease control. So the dilemma is...
And that's with monotherapy.
And that's with monotherapy after several lines of chemotherapy.
That's why these other ones are on the list.
Correct.
My list, anyhow.
You know, it's monotherapy and it's oral.
Well, the other thing is you say BRCA, but now there have been two studies talking about non-BRCA also, ovarian.
Right. So for ovary cancer, I think the benefits of PARP inhibitors probably goes beyond just BRCA status. And I'm actually fairly optimistic one of these drugs will be approved in ovarian cancer soon.
So your final patient, 68-year-old woman with stage 3C ovarian cancer presenting in 2008 fall.
Right. So this patient was optimally resected following her diagnosis and then got chemotherapy, standard of care, carboplatin and paclitaxel, did well for 6 months. So she's, again, progression at 6 months. She's on the border of platinum-sensitive disease. So we opted, because she did not want to receive carboplatin and did not want to lose her hair again, we opted to treat her with pegylated liposomal doxorubicin.
Could we just interject there how her recurrence was diagnosed?
Yes. So in this patient, she actually had serologic recurrence. So her CA-125 actually went up 2 months after we stopped chemotherapy. But she did not progress radiologically until 6 months later.
And was she symptomatic?
She was not symptomatic.
Just out of curiosity, it is interesting to think about the history of where these people were diagnosed. So
yes.
Was that after that plenary presentation about CA-125 screening?
Rustin's, yeah.
So did that change your thinking at all about this, or are you still using screening for these patients?
I'm following patients with CA125. I'm not making treatment decisions based on it.
Right, and she exemplifies that.
Exactly, exactly.
So what was the next step? She got the liposomal doxorubicin.
Right, so she got liposomal doxorubicin and had a very severe skin reaction after several months of that. And
Hand-foot?
Yes, hand-foot. So very severe, painful, blistering rash.
Which treatment? I mean, did it come out of the blue?
No, it came out of the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin.
No, but I'm saying, which treatment? Had she already had a few treatments?
Yes.
She had a few treatments. She was doing well. She gets the treatment and bang.
Yes. So she had had a very, very mild form of it, got her subsequent cycle, and then came back in with a very severe reaction at that point. And even though her CAT scan had not normalized by the time she had had this reaction, her CA125 had stabilized, so not normal, but stabilized, we opted to observe her. And that was beginning in June 2010. And then 3 months after that, so her first interval scan for extent of disease would have been in September of 2010. It already showed she had started to grow back her disease. So at that point, we started her on bevacizumab.
And what happened?
She actually did very well on bevacizumab and actually continues on this agent. Did not respond radiologically, but has had prolonged stable disease.
Symptoms, side effects?
Side effects are hypertension. So she went from requiring a very low dose of a beta blocker to requiring 3 drugs.
Anything else besides that?
Yeah, she has had episodic nosebleeds on this. But overall, she feels the symptoms are very tolerable. So she's never been symptomatic with her hypertension. We've been very aggressive about managing it.
Now, what was the actual site of her disease? Did she have ascites?
She did not have ascites. She had omental disease.
Do you think that people with ascites respond better to bevacizumab?
They definitely have a drying of their ascites on bevacizumab. I've seen that numerous occasions.
How does she compare her quality of life on single agent bevacizumab to her? Well, obviously she had a horrible time with the liposomal doxorubicin, but let's say the carboplatin.
Carboplatin and paclitaxel for this patient was a very hard treatment for her. So when I begin therapy, I usually use the analogy of going through a very long, dark tunnel, but seeing the light at the end. And as you approach your last cycle, it becomes brighter and brighter. Her tunnel was incredibly dark when she was on chemotherapy.
What were the other options that you were considering at the time, and why did you choose bevacizumab, and what do you see in her future?
So we chose bevacizumab because her disease was not causing bowel symptoms, so she had no nausea or vomiting. She was able to eat well, and she had a very good albumin. Radiologically, the disease was not causing CT evidence of bowel compromise, okay? And because it was a biologic antibody, traditional side effects, which she really hated, were not the ones that we needed to worry about on Bev.
If she were to progress in the near future, what would be the next agent you'd be thinking about?
So then we go back to our armamentarium. I would consider trying platinum-based combination if she required a combination, i.e., if she had rapid progression or evolution of disease in her liver and lungs, for example, I may try a combination at that point because of an artificial prolongation in the platinum-free interval. Alternatives would be gemcitabine. I would consider topotecan, and I would consider pemetrexed.
So in your series of 2 of patients on bevacizumab, in these 3 patients that you're presenting today, they both had hypertension and they both seem to do pretty well. And of course, most patients don't actually get hypertension statistically. You agree?
Yes, I would agree with
that. So just kind of curious, if a patient develops hypertension, you got to start changing their meds or starting their meds. Do you say to them, this is a good sign?
No, I don't. No, I guess I'm not part of the camp that believes hypertension is a surrogate marker for tumor response.